there's this parable about a monastery that's in the countryside of central Germany. And the monastery is run by an old monk and his disciples, and the other resident of this monastery is a stray cat. And the reason that the stray cat is here is because the cat preceded the monks, and so they didn't feel right about displacing the cat, so they let it stay, and the cat became friendly with the monks, and it actually became part of this monastic family. The problem with cats, if you've ever been around them, or if you've ever, you know, grew up with them or anything, is that they're very selfish creatures, right? They want what they want, when they want it. They're not particularly concerned with what you're up to. And so the old monk started to realize that every morning when he would go into these moments of contemplative prayer, these deep meditations where he would try to solely focus his entire being on God and let God's presence wash over him in silence and solitude, this was the moment that the cat would decide that it wanted attention. And so the cat would rub up against him and break his solitude, or it would meow and break his silence. And so the monk started a new ritual and a new tradition. And this ritual was that every morning before he sat down to pray like this, he would take this cat and he would tie it to the base of a tree. And then he would go and he would pray. And then he would untie the cat and they would go on with their day. And he did this for years. Eventually the old monk passes away and his disciples take over this monastery. And they've been watching him and they've been learning from him and they've been trying to imitate him. And so they pick up the rituals and the traditions that he was practicing. And so every morning when they come out, they take this cat, and they take it over to the tree, and they tie it to the tree every morning, and then they pray, and then they let the cat go and go on with their day. Well, they do this for a couple years, and then the cat gets old, and the cat passes away. And so the first thing that these monks do upon the cat's death is they hitch a ride into town, and they go to the nearest pet store, and they buy a new cat, because they have to have a cat to tie to the tree before they pray. And you see what's going on here, right? In just a couple years, this ritual, this practice that had a real meaning and real purpose, real reason behind it, right? The reason the monk was tying the cat to the tree was because the cat was a distraction. In just a few years, the meaning and the reason and the logic behind why they do that almost completely went away, and tying a cat to a tree became a ritual for the sake of ritual, tradition, for the sake of tradition. Maybe a more modern, less parable-like example of this is this show that I used to watch that's really, really funny called Idiot Abroad. Has anybody seen this show? It's a good show. It's a show where the comedian Ricky Gervais takes his best friend Carl Pilkington and he sends him into these foreign cultures and makes him participate in these foreign practices. And it's funny because Carl Pilkington is not at all interested in experiencing these foreign cultures, in learning from them, in enlightening himself, or in expanding his horizons. So he goes into these places and he's miserable. And Ricky Gervais basically tortures him and laughs at him, and we laugh along with him. And there's this one scene, this was my favorite scene in all of the show, where Carl goes to Beijing, and the first thing they have him do is go to a traditional Chinese massage, an ancient technique of Chinese massage, and this is what happens to Carl.
Out with a Chinese massage, which isn't like them. That.
Get the socks off.
That's how it starts, isn't it?
You are having a laugh. Come on now.
Oh, God. See that? Is that normal?
Stay back here. Boy. Right, that's hot now, that's mental. Right, that's hot.
What is she doing?
I've seen massages on the telly. You don't normally have to have a fire extinguisher on standby. What is this doing?
It's traditional Chinese massage.
But what? Why? Tell me why, though. Why is this traditional Chinese massage?
I think it relaxes.
No, it doesn't relax me, so what does it do? Why is she setting fire to me? What good is it doing me? Don't just stand there saying it's traditional. It's traditional, it's what they do here, it's a delicacy. What is she doing?
When have gloves on fire ever been associated with having a massage?
Yeah, I can feel it. I can feel it. Right, I felt that. Put it out. Put it out, please.
It's not a good sort of combination, that, really. Having something done like that with a woman who can't understand me.
Ah, that's hot now.
Maybe she's just a frustrated magician or something.
Ah!
Couldn't get a gig doing magic. Ends up doing back rubs, and she's come up with an idea with having gloves that are on fire.
There's something about the premise of going to get a massage and literally getting lit on fire that's funny to me. So I enjoy that episode. Now, the interesting thing about that, if you're paying attention, was the moment that he actually asks a very introspective philosophical question. He says, why is she doing this to me? Why am I being lit on fire right now? And the producer keeps saying, well, it's a traditional ancient massage. And he sits up and he says, well, don't tell me that it's a tradition. Don't tell me that it's ancient. Don't tell me it's just what we do. Tell me why. How is being lit on fire helping me? Tell me why it's happening. What's the reason? And I actually think that this is a question in this context that all of us would be wise to ask perhaps a little bit more frequently than we do. Why do we do the things that we do? Why do we engage in the practices that we engage in? Why do we do the traditions that we participate in, the rituals? Why do we do that? Because here we are today gathered in a building that we turn into a church every Sunday. And the Christian church has been around for 2,000 years. And so there's all kinds of ancient symbols and traditions and practices that have piled up over the years. And I think the part of the job of Jesus followers, of disciples of Jesus, is to ask the question, not just do them because they're there, but ask the question, why do we do them? Why do we participate in these things? Why is it meaningful? How does it help us? And ultimately, what does it symbolize? Today is the first ever 514 Church Baptism Sunday, all right? The first time ever, we are taking an entire Sunday, we're dedicating it to baptism. We have five people this service who are getting baptized. We have eight people next service. And what these people are going to do is they're going to come up here, they're going to get into this water, into this tub, in front of all of you people, and somebody is going to dunk them underneath the water and then pull them out through the water, and everybody's going to cheer. And the first time that I ever saw this happen in this kind of context, I was like 17 years old, and the person came up, and he went in the water, and he came out of the water, and everybody cheered. And I was like, okay, I like the energy. This is good. This is great. Good vibes. But somebody's going to have to explain to me what that is. I mean, why did they just put him in water in front of everybody in the middle of a place that's not a pool? Why did we do that? And you want to know what the amazing thing is about that experience that I had? Nobody ever did. No one ever told me why we do it. No one ever explained what it means, what the symbolism was, what happens. And so today, before we take part in this beautiful tradition, this amazing moment of celebration, we are going to talk about why we do it. Why do we baptize? Why do we do it? And in my opinion, the best place to look for these Christian traditions and the depth and the texture behind them is the scriptures. And I think that the Bible is actually one unified story from beginning to end. And it has a lot of subplots in the middle, and it has a lot of different directions that it goes. But if you read it like a narrative, it starts in the beginning and it ends at the end. I think it's a story. And when you read it like that, you start to see that there are these certain themes that start at the beginning and then weave their way throughout the scriptures. And so you see something here, and you see it here, and you see it here, and it's building upon itself, and it's creating a thematic emphasis. That's really beautiful when you read the Bible that way. And one of the interesting things is about today, coming through the water, baptism, is that this idea of coming through the waters is actually a key theme of Scripture. The idea of someone or something coming through the waters and signifying something important and transformational is actually a key theme of the entire book, of the entire story, from page one to the end. And the first time that this theme pops up, that we see it in action, is on the first page. The first page of the whole Bible, where it all begins, Genesis chapter 1, page 1. And Genesis chapter 1 is what some people call the creation story, the creation narrative. It's an ancient Hebrew cosmology, and it explains what kind of world we live in. What kind of God created this world? What kind of beings are we? What is our relationship to this God? What does it mean to be a human? Some of these deep existential questions are actually founded in the first page of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1. And so for this theme, it pops up right here as well. The first two sentences of the whole book go like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And so the first scene in the Bible, in the creation story, is an earth that's here, but it's covered in these chaotic, disordered waters. Now, because the earth is covered in these waters that are defined by disorder and chaos and darkness, life cannot flourish in that world. And so the story of Genesis chapter 1 is what God does to that world to make it a place where life can flourish. It's not about God creating something out of nothing. It's about what he reaches into those chaotic waters, into that disorder and darkness, and what he pulls out of the waters. What comes through the waters is a garden. It's a garden called Eden. And the garden, rather than being chaotic and disordered, is ordered and beautiful and good. And because of that, life now cannot just exist, but life flourishes in this good, ordered, beautiful garden. Through the water, God brings order and beauty and goodness. He reaches into the water, through the water, a good world where life can flourish. Now, at the apex of God's creative powers, he creates you and me. He creates human beings, and he calls us images. And in the original language, the word for image is probably better translated as representation. And so you and me, humans, we are actually representations of the very God that we worship. And that's cool in and of itself, but then he gives his representations a task. He says, be fruitful and multiply. Take this garden that I just pulled from the chaos and the darkness and go cover the whole globe with it. Take it everywhere. He says, subdue the earth, which means cultivate it, right? Because God is bringing order, beauty, goodness out of the earth. He gives us a good earth and says, make this better. Make this even better, more order, more beauty, more goodness. Have dominion over this good world that I've created. And so what he's tasking human beings with is to rule and reign in his good world on his behalf, furthering the order, furthering the beauty, and furthering the goodness so that life can further flourish. Being a human means not just being a representation of God, but being a representative of God and ruling this world on his behalf, in his name. That's what it means to be a human. That is our vocation. That's the purpose for which we were created. And in order to do that, we have been given these incredibly transformational powers. These powers, right? Because if we're going to take this world and transform it into something even better, we have to have the powers to be able to do so. And so we've been given those powers. It's in our bones. It's in our soul. It's in our being, right? When we move into spaces and we touch them, they change. When we move into relationships with people, they change. It's impossible for you as a human to just exist in this world, to just exist. It's impossible because that's not the way that you were created. You were created to create and to transform because you're God's stewards, you're his representatives. And so we move into spaces and places and they change, and we're supposed to use that power to bring order and beauty and goodness to make the good world even better. So the tragedy of the scriptures, the tragedy of the fall, if you've ever heard the story when they eat the apple, the tragedy of the human condition that we seem to find ourselves in is not really about disobedience, partially. It's not really that God gave us a rule, we broke the rule, and now the world is broken. The problem is that we take these immense powers to transform the world into something better, and we abuse them, and we misappropriate them. We give them away to things that shouldn't be worshipped. And so instead of ruling the world on God's behalf, we rule the world on our own behalf, and we give these powers away to these forces that the scriptures call idols. Think about it. Money, power, sex, self-interest, greed, all of these things that seem to run our lives, that when you really take a step back and look at yourself, that you do seem to worship. All of these things, when we give these amazing powers we have to them, instead of bringing order and beauty and goodness into the good world that God pulled out of the darkness and chaos, we start to bring disorder and chaos and darkness and death back into the world. The very thing from which he pulled us and made it good, we seem to want to take back. Rather than ruling the world on God's behalf, we participate in and we create disorder and chaos. And if that's true, if that's the right way to read this story, then it makes the next story that has to do with water make a lot more sense. What's the next story in the Bible still in the first book, that has to do with a lot of water. The flood story, right? Noah's Ark. There's a story we all learned as kids, but no one ever really told us what it meant. The flood story is at this moment where humans have now abused this power into the creation of entire cities and cultures, right? There's entire cities, cultures, civilizations built upon this disorder and chaos and death and idol worship that you see in the fall. And so God looks at the world, and this is what God says. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. It grieved him to his heart. So he looks at what humans are doing. And just to level with everybody theologically for a second, when you read this story, is God angry? Is he really like wrathful and vengeful? Has his honor been besmirched and now he must spill the blood of those who've dishonored him? That's not really what it says. It says he's sad. It says he's grieved to his heart. It says he's heartbroken. Why? Because of what we're doing to the world. Because he put us in charge of this good place and told us to make it better, ruled on his behalf, and instead we've abused these powers he's given us. We give them away to these created things, these other forces. And these forces seem to have such sway over us that we've built civilization on it. And he looks at it and he's sad. And so it says, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. And the earth floods for 40 days and 40 nights, and only Noah and the animals and his family on the ship remain. And so what just happened? We see the story, we're talking about water today, right? What is the logical progression of the stories that we've walked through so far? Well, in the beginning, there were chaos waters. And through the chaos waters, God pulled order and beauty and goodness and life. And then he put us in charge of it and said, do even more of this. And instead, we've become compromised by these other things that we want to worship and give our powers away to. And we bring the very disorder and death back into the world from which we came from. And I think the flood story is back into the waters we go. Out of the waters we came, look over this, make it better. We don't make it better. We take it back to where we started, which is disorder and violence and death and chaos. Back into the water. See, I think that the flood story is a decreation story. I think the flood story is a story that shows us what happens when humans are left to our own devices. In the condition that we're in, with the compromised nature of the fact that we want to worship these other things, that we just seem to be enslaved by these other forces that we give our powers away to, if left to our own devices, we'll take it back into the chaos waters. We'll take it back into the water. We'll take it all the way back to the beginning. And if that's true, then the promise that God makes to Noah when he gets off the boat is really, really amazing. Because Noah gets off the boat and God says, well, I see that evil is still only in the hearts of humans continuously. And you're like, well, that's not good. If, you know, that means that he has to get rid of humans probably. And then God says, but I promise that I'll never do this again. So you got to think, he'll never do what again? Well, what brought the world back into the chaos? Humans, left to our own devices. So what is God never going to do again? He's never going to leave us to our own devices. He's never going to allow us to take it back to that state. You see, the two options that God has is to get rid of us because we're compromised, or to get rid of these forces that we give ourselves away to defeat them that compromise us. And he promises in this moment that he refuses to go on without us. He refuses to move on in this project of creation without us, even though we're compromised, even though when left to our own devices, we might dismantle the whole thing instead of create it more. He promises he'll never go on without us. And so the question of the scriptures that you go on to read, because we're only on page 8, by the way, so this book is crazy, right? The rest of the story of the scriptures is how is God going to restore this place back to the garden? How is God going to remake his images who are now compromised? How is God going to recreate all of this? How is God going to retell this tragic story? And ultimately, if the problem is that we're enslaved to these other things, how is God going to free us? How is he going to redeem us from that bondage? And the stories of the scripture tell that narrative. And it's really important that we understand this to start with, because, again, if the two options are get rid of humans or confront and defeat the forces that compromise us, and he promises to not get rid of us, then the only option that he has left is he's going to confront and he's going to defeat these forces of evil and sin that seem to enslave us, these idols that we worship, that we give ourselves away to, that have the ability to decreate this place. And the interesting thing when you start to, like, read the Bible as a story, and as you start to follow Jesus, you start to understand that God hardly ever works in the way that you think he's going to. And if we're honest with ourselves, which we typically aren't out loud, but if we are honest with ourselves, he never really does it the way that we want him to. And so the story of how he goes about this redemption is somewhat like that. I mean, it's a very interesting way that he weaves this all together. And the way that he does it is he chooses a subset of humanity to save humanity. He says, he calls a man named Abraham, and he says, I'm going to make a nation out of you, and through you and your family, the whole world will be blessed. The whole world will be redeemed. All of this will be put back together right again through the nation of Israel. And so most of the Bible is about the story of Israel. And at one of the climactic moments of Israel's story, they are together as a nation, and they wander upon the land that God had promised them, called the land of milk and honey, the land of Canaan, the promised land. And this land is important because if they're going to launch a rescue mission, they need a home base, right? They need a place to launch it from. And so the nation of Israel comes upon this land, and the only thing that separates them from the promised land is the Jordan River. And so God parts the waters of the Jordan River, and the nation of Israel goes through the waters into God's mission to save the world. Through the waters, into God's mission. Now, the twist in the story, as you read it, you'll become frustrated, because the problem is that Israel is supposed to rescue humanity, but they're subject to the same problem that humanity is subject to. So how's it go for them? Not very well. It goes for them about the same way it would go for us, right? They're just as compromised as us. They're just as likely to give their powers away to other things. And what ends up happening is because of this, they end up getting destroyed. They get taken over by Babylon, and then they get taken over by several other empires. By the time of Jesus, the Roman Empire is ruling over them in their own land. And when you look back at some of the prophets and some of the other books, like, this experiment seems to be a disaster. And so a man, a prophet, comes along named John the Baptist. And John the Baptist shows up, and he's like kind of like a crazy man, all right? He's got wild clothing, and he eats a weird diet. And he shows up, and he starts telling people, you need to start over again. And he takes them, and he puts them into Jordan River, and he dunks them underneath the water. He baptizes them, and he sends them back in to start over again, right? Because through the Jordan River, Israel originally came. It didn't go well. So John the Baptist is having a revival movement to dunk them in the Jordan again and send them back in, starting new. But as John knows, the problem is not that we need to start over, because if we start over, we'll become compromised again. The problem is that we need to be made new. The problem is not that we need a fresh start. The problem is that we need to be transformed. The problem is that we need to be created into something different. Something has to happen that changes us. And the Jewish people knew that that person who would inaugurate that was going to be somebody called the Messiah. And so there's this moment where John is dunking people, and he sees Jesus, And just imagine the drama. He's dunking people, telling them that he's starving. He sees Jesus, and he says, that's him. That's the one. He's the one right there. The Lamb of God. He's the one who's going to do this. He's the one who's going to save us all. And he baptizes Jesus, and he sends Jesus through the waters into God's mission as the final solution to the problems that plague us, to these forces, to this darkness. And so Jesus' mission is to confront these forces of sin and evil and figure out how to free us from that. Now, it's interesting because these forces of sin and evil, how do they manifest themselves in the world? Through humans. So in order to confront the forces of evil, the people through whom these forces work have to be confronted themselves. And so Jesus walks into Israel, into all of that chaos and darkness, into the state of humanity, and he announces a new kingdom, a new way of being human, a new way of living, and he's rejected. And he's put up on a cross by his own leadership, by his own people, and by the Roman government. Who puts Jesus on a cross? People. Humans. Right? It's not that God needs to kill Jesus. People. Because of what we're enslaved to, because of what we worship, you know, Jesus walks full force into that, and it puts him on a cross. And so the cross is this moment where all of these forces of sin and evil and death that Jesus has come to confront and free us from culminate, come to like a tidal wave and completely submerge and subsume him. In the same way that the flood submerged and subsumed the earth, the chaos, the darkness, right? It's all symbolic. In the same way, the evil and the forces that bring that chaos and darkness subsume and submerge Jesus on the cross, and it kills him. The very forces that he came to defeat, defeat him. And he dies. And so do the things that kill him, die with him. And the reason that we are Easter people as Christians, the reason that we gather on Sundays every week is because of what happens next. See, after being completely submerged and subsumed in the chaos and the evil and darkness that we are supposed to be freed from, he dies, but he doesn't stay dead. He raises from the dead on the third day. He resurrects from the dead. And in that moment, he defeats those forces once and for all, because if they can't keep him dead, they can't beat him. The consequence of these forces is death. So if Jesus defeats death, the very consequence of the existence of these things, then these things are defeated forever. They can't hold him. He defeats them forever in that moment. And this is what the gospel is. It's not something different. It's not this is what it is. It's that we are enslaved and we need freed. And the gospel is that that's exactly what Jesus did by walking into these forces, by being completely submerged by them, just like the waters in Genesis 1, just like the waters again in the flood story, completely subsumed and submerged. They kill him and he raises from the dead, defeating the very things that enslave us forever. So the question is, what does that have to do with us, and what does that have to do with baptism? What is baptism, how does it symbolize something in this beautiful gospel story? Well, I have to let the Apostle Paul explain, because he's like slightly better theologian than me. All right, this is what he says. This is what Paul says in his letter to the Romans. He says in Romans chapter 6, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? Should we keep giving ourselves over to these things so that God can just keep saving us? And he says something really interesting. He says, how can we who die to sin still live in it? What does that mean? Do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus were actually baptized into his death? We were buried, therefore, with him by baptism, so that just as he was raised, we too may walk in the newness of life. What Paul is saying baptism communicates is that the faith that we profess as Christians is not something spiritual and ethereal somewhere else. It's real. It's flesh and blood. That's why our God became flesh and blood, to save us in flesh and blood. What he's saying is that somehow, some way, we are bound to Jesus. That somehow what happened to Jesus is happening to us. What happened to Jesus, dying to sin and death, dying to these things that enslave us, and raising from the dead, defeating these things, is somehow happening to us. We are bound to him. And so when we put our faith in him, we bind ourselves to him. And so what happened to him starts happening to us. And so baptism is a physical symbol. It's something that we do with our hands, with our bodies, because what we are being saved from is a physical thing. It's real. You can touch it. You can feel it. And so baptism is this moment that we're going to celebrate here where into the water we go. And the evil and the darkness and the sin and the chaos and the disorder and the death of all those stories before, all of those things that we give ourselves away to that compromise us as God's images go under the water with us, and we die just like Jesus on the cross. We're completely submerged in the chaos, just like Jesus on the cross, just like the earth in Genesis 1, just like the earth again in flood story, completely submerged, and we die, and those forces die with us. And then through the water we come, raised to freedom, to goodness, to beauty, to new life, just like Jesus. Just like the resurrection, baptism symbolizes the way in which we're inextricably linked to our Savior, that what happened to him is actually happening to us. We are dying to our old selves. We're dying to the things that used to enslave us, that we worship that we shouldn't. We're dying to those things, and we are raising to new life because of Jesus Christ. New humans, new creation. You see, his death is ours. His resurrection is ours. His victory over everything that compromises us is ours simply because we are his. We are linked to Jesus. We're linked to him. What happened to Jesus is happening to all of us. And so baptism is not a celebration simply of thinking that somebody does this, and so now when they die, they go to heaven. Baptism is a celebration of new creation. Right now. New creation is popping up right now. And baptism symbolizes the way in which we die to the old and we raise new because of what happened to Jesus. And so these people are going to come up here. They're going to celebrate this. They're going to do this symbolic act in front of everybody, proving that what happened to Jesus is happening to them, and we, as their community, celebrate. And so we're gonna, when we start this music, we're gonna stand up. And when they start going under the water, we're gonna go nuts. We're gonna cheer, we're gonna celebrate, and we celebrate not simply because one person is being affected in one moment, but we celebrate because what this symbolizes is something cosmic and eternal. And we celebrate not just because somebody's being washed clean of their bad things that they've done. We celebrate because right now, in the middle of a lot of times what feels like darkness, people are coming out of the waters bathed in the light of the resurrection. We celebrate because it seems, when you look around, that evil and sin and death are reigning in this world, and yet people are coming out of the waters today, through the waters, no longer subject to those things, no longer enslaved. Into the waters we go, dead to our old selves, dead to all of these things that compromise us, and out of the water we come as glimmers of resurrection life, glimmers of new life, glimmers of new creation. And so when the band comes out and starts to play and these people start coming up, we are going to celebrate. We're going to celebrate and we're going to go crazy.